Stay tuned for Africa News Tonight, coming up right after these latest world news headlines.
I'm Frances Alonso reporting. Former United Nations Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali has died, according to the UN Security Council President announcement Tuesday. He was the sixth Secretary General of the United Nations. The Egyptian-born politician and diplomat served in the office from 1992 to 1996. He was admitted to a Cairo hospital last week. Boutros-Ghali was 93. You can read more details at voanews.com. Four of the world's biggest oil-producing nations have reached an agreement to freeze output to tackle the global oil surplus. The oil ministers of Russia, Saudi Arabia, Venezuela, and Qatar agreed to the pact on Tuesday during a closed-door meeting in the Qatar capital of Doha. The quartet will freeze output at January levels. This is the Saudi Arabian oil minister.
It is a beginning of a process which we will assess in the next few months and decide whether we need other steps to stabilize and improve the market.
In reaction, oil prices dropped to under $34 a barrel after the output freeze was announced. Observers predict oil prices will eventually fall to at least $20 a barrel before any recovery begins. Ukrainian President Petro Poroshenko Tuesday asked Prime Minister Arseniy Yatsenyuk to stand down in the face of the government's perceived failure to fight endemic corruption and overcome its economic crisis. Poroshenko's dramatic intervention came as opinion polls showed growing public disenchantment with a pro-Western team that took over the leadership of the former Soviet nation after the 2014 revolt. VOA News. Candidates in Uganda are holding final rallies Tuesday ahead of the country's presidential and legislative elections. Voters are to decide Thursday whether to give President Yoweri Museveni a fifth term or elect an opposition candidate and have a new leader for the first time since 1986. Museveni took power in a coup and won landslide elections in 2006 and 2011. Observers say they were marred by irregularities and intimidation of opposition parties. Air attacks in northern Syria that damaged or destroyed schools and hospitals and that left at least 50 dead has drawn international condemnation. UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon called the attacks a blatant violation of international law. Susan Rice, a U.S. National Security Advisor, also denounced the strikes that some believe were carried out by government or Russian forces.
What concerns us is that as the violence continues, more and more civilians are being impacted. And the pressure on civilians and the outflow of displaced persons from their areas of residence is increasing. And that is why we have put a premium on trying to halt the violence, enable humanitarian access, and create an environment that is conducive for a political track to get underway.
The international reaction comes as UN envoy for Syria, Stefan de Mistura, is in the country in holding talks Tuesday with officials on implementing a ceasefire this week. He arrived late Monday in the Syrian capital of Damascus for the unannounced visit. World powers agreed last week to a cessation of hostilities set to begin on Friday in order to let badly needed humanitarian aid be delivered. Three Americans abducted in Baghdad last month have been freed, according to Iraqi officials Tuesday. Unknown gunmen kidnapped the three from a private apartment in mid-January, with U.S. and Iraqi officials saying they believed an Iranian-backed Shiite militia carried out the abduction. The Americans are reported to be in good health, and the U.S. Embassy did not immediately comment on their release. Four American journalists charged in Bahrain have been released and are due to fly out of the country, according to their lawyer Tuesday. The journalists were arrested Sunday and had been charged earlier in the day with illegally assembling with the intent to commit a crime. The journalists went to Bahrain to cover the anniversary of the island's pro-democracy protests that were crushed by authorities 5 years ago. They were arrested on Sunday in the Shiite town of Sitra during clashes between protesters and security forces. More details on this and more at voanews.com. I'm Frances Alonso in Washington.
That's the latest world news from VOA.
Good evening and welcome to Africa News Tonight from the English to Africa service of the Voice of America. I'm Kim Lewis in Washington.
And I'm Yehiz Wuhib. Coming up this hour on Africa News Tonight,
Cameroon says its soldiers have liberated the northeastern Nigerian town of Goshen from Boko Haram and handed it to the Nigerian government. A spokesman for the government of Cameroon says more than 160 Boko Haram fighters were killed and hundreds of hostages, both Cameroonian and Nigerian, freed.
That's Moki Edwin Kenzeka reporting from Yaoundé. Details coming up.
Also, the mayor of Bujumbura bans motorbikes from the center of the Burundi capital to try to reduce the number of grenade attacks there. And opposition parties in the DRC call for a nationwide strike and are demanding that President Joseph Kabila step down when his current term ends.
We'll have these stories, plus the sunny side of sports with Sunny Young, music from Guinea-Bissau, and our daily features. So stay with us. There's lots more ahead on Africa News Tonight.
Our top story this hour, Cameroon says its soldiers have liberated the northeastern Nigerian town of Goshen from Boko Haram and handed it to the Nigerian government. A spokesman for the government of Cameroon says more than 160 Boko Haram fighters were killed and hundreds of hostages, both Cameroonian and Nigerian, freed. Moki Edwin Kenzaga reports from Yaoundé.
Cameroon Communications Minister Issa Chiruma Bakari says between February 11 and 14, Cameroon's military launched raids on Goshen, where intelligence reports indicated Boko Haram fighters were running training camps and bomb factories. He says the terrorists were also training teenagers, especially girls, and brainwashing them to be suicide bombers. He says Cameroon obtained the approval of Nigeria to free Goshen from the insurgents.
During this victorious assault, 162 Boko Haram terrorists were neutralized. Four artisanal mine factories were dismantled. A previously identified training center was set ablaze. War weapons seized. The operation led by Cameroonian special forces also led to the release of hundreds of people made prisoner by Boko Haram. Several Nigerian hostages were also freed.
The spokesman says Cameroon lost two soldiers in the battle, adding that Nigerian troops celebrated the victory with Cameroon troops who have now left Goshen, a town 15 kilometers from Cameroon's border with Nigeria. Regional forces from Cameroon, Nigeria, Chad, Niger, and Benin have been launching raids on Boko Haram strongholds along the border since last year. According to the United Nations and Amnesty International, Boko Haram's six-year insurgency has killed over 20,000 people and displaced 2.5 million people. Moki Edwin Kinzika for VOA News, Yaoundé.
The Nigerian army's offensive against Boko Haram militants has led to the release of men, women, and children who had been abducted in recent years. However, a new report says many women and girls returning home have been met with fear, distrust, and stigma. VOA's Jody Kapowa reports.
It's estimated as many as 2,000 women and girls have been abducted by Boko Haram since 2009. But there are no exact figures on just how many have been freed or escaped. The new report looks at obstacles many face after they've been freed. It's called Bad Blood: Perceptions of Children Born of Conflict-Related Sexual Violence and Women and Girls Associated with Boko Haram. The research was done by the peacebuilding group International Alert, with help from the UN Children's Fund, UNICEF, and funded by Japan. Kim Toogood is an advisor for International Alert.
Many family members, husbands, in some cases polygamous co-wives and families, community leaders, traditional rulers, most people meet the women and girls with a lot of skepticism. They do believe that Boko Haram has a juju or charms that they have placed on women and girls while they were associated with them in captivity.
She says that makes it hard for the women and girls to be welcomed with open arms.
While the woman or girl returns to their community, they are ostracized at the very beginning while communities try to figure out if the Jujus have kind of taken control of the woman, if she shares the ideology with Boko Haram due to her exposure to them. People believe that if they've been exposed to them over a certain period of time, they may find some sympathy with them.
The research was conducted in Borno State in northeast Nigeria. The report finds that while humanitarian assistance was reaching Boko Haram survivors and returnees, it was still inadequate for the breadth and depth of the need. Toogood says the report's title, Bad Blood, is a term used by community members for children born of rape.
They literally mean that because these children conceived of rape are now half blood of Boko Haram and half blood of their mother, that that child will never be anything worthy to society. They say a child of a snake is a snake, or the child will be a hyena among dogs. It will always stick out. It will always be ugly and scruffy and never really belong. And then eventually it will just do what hyenas do and eat the other dogs.
She says most of the Nigerian women and girls interviewed said they decided to keep their babies despite the stigma.
Mostly because they said by the time they got to the IDP camp, they had already had the child. And also they said it's not the child's fault. This child didn't ask to be born into this world, but they're going to love that child. In most of our cases, they were Muslim women who were giving their testimonies that they said they didn't think that God or Allah would give them more than they could handle. And therefore, they said, this child needs to be loved just like any of my other children, regardless if it's a boy or a girl, or it's conceived of rape, or it's conceived of love.
But Toogood says many did feel guilty about their captivity.
Overall, the survivors had a lot of trauma. They had a lot of guilt. Like, why couldn't I have run faster? Why couldn't I have escaped from being held captive? A lot of guilt related to being separated from their children if they had children previously before they were captive.
Local religious leaders lent their support to helping the kidnapped victims.
For example, religious leaders across the board in the IDP camps where we implemented this research said that according to the Quran, forgiveness and acceptance and reintegration for husbands of their wives is in line with Islamic principles. So one of the things that we try to do in this current project is try to put a lot of religious leaders on the radio, and we want the religious leaders to kind of explain that position.
Other recommendations include increasing psychosocial support for the women and girls, raising awareness among Nigerian officials, police, and military so they can better communicate with abduction victims, establishing peace-building clubs in schools and communities, and strengthening anti-discrimination laws to protect survivors and their children. April marks the second anniversary of Boko Haram's kidnapping of hundreds of schoolgirls from Chibok. Joe DiCapua, VOA News, Washington.
The mayor of Bujumbura has banned motorbikes from the center of the Burundi capital to try to reduce the number of grenade attacks there. The French news agency AFP reports the ban was implemented after attacks in which men on motorbikes threw three grenades. One child was killed, but many other people were wounded. Two other attacks were reported in another northern suburb. The medical aid group Doctors Without Borders says it retreated more than 60 people in yesterday's attacks, including many women and children. They treated 55 people after attacks on February 11th. Hundreds have died in violence since April. That's when President Pierre Nkurunziza announced he would seek a third term in office. He won re-election, but critics call it unconstitutional. About a quarter of a million Burundians have fled to other countries. Grenade attacks in Bujumbura are now common. Security forces, rebels, and opposition members all claim they are not responsible.
Opposition parties in the Democratic Republic of Congo have called for a nationwide strike and are demanding that President Joseph Kabila step down when his current term ends. Tensions have been rising in the DRC over Mr. Kabila's possible bid for a third term in office. His second five-year term expires in December, and the Constitution bars him from running again. He has not announced his political intentions yet. Elections are scheduled for November. Last year, 40 people were killed in violent protests over allegations that Mr. Kabila was attempting to delay November's elections.
African Union election observers in the Central African Republic say the two polls held in the country on Sunday were conducted peacefully and transparently. Some provisional results of the presidential poll in the capital have been released, and so far they show Faustin Archange Touadéra in the lead. Nick Long files from Bangui.
The African Union has a full-scale election observer mission in CAR led by the former Prime Minister of Senegal, Souleymane Ndene Ndiaye. Ndiaye told reporters here Tuesday that his teams visited most of the polling stations in Bangui and some others outside the capital, a total of more than 120 polling stations in all. An earlier attempt to hold the first round of legislative elections in late December was a failure. The poll was so flawed that the Constitutional Court annulled the results, although it confirmed the first round results of the presidential poll. This time, both polls seem to have passed off acceptably, according to the AU observers.
L'élection s'est déroulée dans une atmosphère de paix et de quiétude.
Ndiaye says the mission's preliminary finding is that the elections were held in a peaceful and quiet atmosphere at the places where the mission was present. Generally, he says the vote was held in accordance with the required procedure and the electoral law. He noted that the turnout was lower than in the first round of the presidential poll. According to the CAR's National Election Authority, the turnout might have been as high as 63%. And Dana did not comment on that estimate. Other observers here think it was lower. The main problem seemed to be lack of voting material at some centres, but this was less serious than the first round where there was a shortfall of several hundred thousand ballot papers. But on the whole, the AU mission has given these polls its seal of approval. Certainly there were logistical and organisational difficulties, but these did not prevent Central Africans from voting, says Ndiaye. The mission notes that the difficulties involved in holding these polls were not such as to cast doubt on their credibility. The National Election Authority began releasing provisional results of the presidential poll Tuesday. An official read out results polling station by polling station.
Au bureau de vote numéro 2 de l'école Bonberger, dans le 3e arrondissement.
He read results from about 60% of polling stations in the capital Bangui and in the surrounding prefecture Ombela Mpoko. These provisional results show former Prime Minister Faustin Archange Touadéra clearly in the lead. The election authority did not give a roundup of total votes, but Touadéra beat his opponent, also a former Prime Minister, Anissé Georges Dolegele, by a big margin in a large majority of constituencies announced. The election authority said it is giving out these partial results now to avoid unfounded claims by political parties. Dolegele may have polled better in the rest of the country. Nick Long for VOA News, Bangui.
Campaigning for Uganda's elections officially came to a close today, with all the main presidential candidates holding rallies. Many voters were still angry about yesterday's events when police briefly arrested opposition candidate Chizi Besigye. VOA's Elizabeth Paulette explores the reactions of those attending the final rallies of the 2016 presidential race.
Tensions and uncertainty were high after the arrest Monday of presidential candidate Kizza Besigye. Although Besigye was held for only a short period of time, his arrest sparked massive protests at Makerere University and in downtown Kampala. Police dispersed the crowds with tear gas and live ammunition, resulting in multiple injuries and one fatality. The response was widely condemned by the opposition, including presidential candidate Amama Mbabazi, who held his final rally Tuesday outside Kampala. He told reporters the violence Monday was avoidable.
It's absolutely unnecessary. Why would you hold the presidential candidate and cause the kind of fracas there was yesterday? All he was doing was going through the streets to go to his final public rally, I think. Absolutely unacceptable and uncalled for. So I condemned it, and I hope the police and the state will desist from such actions.
Besigye was allowed to campaign on the final day and given a police-sanctioned route away from President Yoweri Museveni's final rally at the city's airstrip.
We want change! We want change! We want change!
Flanked by thousands of supporters, the ride through the city was peaceful, although many still expressed anger about Monday's events.
We shall not allow this. Everybody is annoyed. We are very pissed for this and we must fight. Come 2016, February 18th, I'm very ready for change. I have go up country. I vote. I guard my vote until it is announced. We shall win this race. I'm very sure what they have done has gained that more popularity.
At the Kilolo airstrip, where Museveni had his rally, supporters arrived on buses from different parts of the country. With the main stage packed with performers, many expressed happiness at the way Museveni has run his campaign. Many voters say they have seen progress in the past few years and think Museveni has run a fair race. They say they expect the voting process to go smoothly. One voter named Frank says he sees Museveni as a paternal figure.
They are welcoming the president now.
Yeah.
Now supporting him now. Even I'm supporting him. Sure. I'm supporting him. At my age, I was born at, it was 1990. Up to now, I'm still with him. When his situation is now. So, all like that. That's how I'm supporting him. All like that.
Museveni, in power since 1986, is favored to win another term in Thursday's election. This is Besigye's fourth attempt to unseat the president, and Mbabazi's first. Elizabeth Pola for VOA News, Kampala.
In news on Europe's refugee crisis, German Chancellor Angela Merkel is opposing a plan to close the route taken by refugees and migrants through the Balkans. AFP reports she is instead backing a plan with Turkey to reduce the number of people coming to European Union countries. Under the plan, Turkey would seal its borders and fly refugees to Europe to be settled using a quota system. AFP reports there is little support for such a plan. Poland, the Czech Republic, Slovakia, and Hungary have refused to go along with it. Those countries have also said they would help Macedonia and Bulgaria close their borders with Greece. Greece is the main arrival point for the many migrants and refugees leaving Turkey who are on their way to other European countries. Germany has taken in most of them. Most of those coming to Europe are Syrians.
The conflict in Syria is the driving force behind Europe's crisis. Today, the UN High Commissioner for Human Rights condemned airstrikes on at least four hospitals and one school in northern Syria yesterday. He says the attacks could amount to war crimes if they were deliberately targeted. Lisa Schlein reports from the High Commissioner's headquarters in Geneva.
The United Nations reports scores of people were killed and many more injured in the aerial attacks, which have been widely blamed on Syria's government and its ally, Russia. Four missiles reportedly hit one of the hospitals run by the charity Doctors Without Borders. Additionally, another facility, a mother and child hospital supported by the United Nations Children's Fund, was struck with heavy loss of life in the bombardment. This hospital had previously come under attack on December 25th. UN High Commissioner for Human Rights spokesman Rupert Colville tells VOA he does not know whether attacks against medical facilities and personnel have increased since Russia began bombing what it says are terrorist targets in Syria.
It's a bit hard to judge a motivation like that, but the sheer scale of these attacks would suggest that it could well be a tactic of war. So this apparent, at least partial targeting of hospitals, it's very difficult to tell with an individual event immediately whether it's a deliberate targeting, obviously. But the situation is just quite atrocious.
Colville says it is not clear whether these hospital facilities were intentionally targeted, but he adds it is difficult to believe that all these strikes were a result of accidents.
The sheer number of incidents raises huge question marks about the failure of the parties to the conflict in Syria to respect the special protections afforded to medical facilities and personnel under international humanitarian law. Depending on the circumstances, an airstrike on a hospital may constitute a war crime.
Since the Syrian conflict began almost 5 years ago, the World Health Organization reports nearly 700 health workers have been killed and that an estimated 60% of public hospitals and 49% of primary health centers have become either partially or completely non-functional. Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
World Health Organization Director General Dr. Margaret Chan travels to Brazil next week to see the effects of the Zika virus outbreak firsthand. The Associated Press reports the WHO is weighing the use of genetically modified mosquitoes to help control or eradicate the Aedes aegypti mosquitoes that carry the virus. In field experiments in the Cayman Islands, sterile male mosquitoes were released to mate with wild females in an effort to control dengue fever. An expert at the London School of Hygiene and Tropical Medicine calls the move unprecedented. Jimmy Whitworth says genetically modified mosquitoes would help rid the region of Aedes aegypti, and he says he's optimistic that eradication would not damage the environment. However, environmentalists say the long-term effects of such a campaign are not known. The mosquito is not native to Latin America, but was imported hundreds of years ago. Besides Zika and dengue, it also transmits yellow fever. Zika infection is linked to microcephaly, a condition that causes small heads in infants, among other birth defects.
The European Union has launched a new medical body aimed at quickly responding to emergencies like Ebola and Zika. Lisa Bryant has more from Paris.
The European Union's medical corps will be able to act both within and outside Europe. EU Commissioner for Humanitarian Aid Christos Stylianides, who announced the body on Monday, says it will allow the region to respond to health crises more quickly and more efficiently.
Allowing Europe to deploy medical teams, field hospitals, public health experts, LAMPS, medical capacity and logistical support. Rapidly and predictably.
The new body was developed after the Ebola outbreak that ravaged West Africa. Its creation underscores the problems of quickly responding to the crisis and coping with the logistical and other challenges Ebola raised. Today, another virus, Zika, is alarming the international health community. Speaking in Brussels, World Health Organization head Margaret Chan discussed how efforts to contain Zika, which is spread by mosquitoes, are different than those focused on Ebola.
Mosquito control rests with every household. If I tell you two-thirds of the mosquitoes brew in households instead of in the environment, so that means every household must take their act. The government alone cannot do it all.
Commissioner Stylianides says so far, 9 EU states have pledged teams and equipment for the medical body, which will be linked with WHO. He called on other member states to join. Lisa Bryant for VOA News, Paris.
This is African News Tonight with Kim Lewis. I'm Yehi Suhib in Washington. It's 28 minutes past the hour on The Voice of America.
Next time on Straight Talk Africa, we'll discuss the Uganda presidential elections with Shaka Sali in Uganda and me, Esther Gidu Yuart, as the studio guest host. Tune in to Straight Talk Africa next Wednesday at 18:30 UTC right here on VOA Africa.
When news is happening, VOA Africa is there.
Mohamed Yusuf of VOA News, Nairobi.
Victor Beatty, VOA News, Washington.
Lisa Schlein for VOA News, Geneva.
For VOA News, I am Charlton Doki in Joba.
Moki Edwin Kinzuka for VOA News, Yaoundé.
VOA correspondents take you right to the center of events as they're happening. And this is where you hear it all on VOA Africa.
This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America. Here's a brief recap of our top stories this hour. Cameroon says its soldiers have liberated the northeastern Nigerian town of Goshi from Boko Haram and handed it to the Nigerian government. The mayor of Bujumbura bans motorbikes from the center of the Burundi capital to try to reduce the number of grenade attacks there. And opposition parties in the DRC call for a nationwide strike. They're demanding that President Joseph Kabila step down when his current term ends. Coming up, we'll have music from Guinea-Bissau and, in our feature segment, a call by the UN to end female circumcision. I'm Kim Lewis with Yeheya Swuhib, and we're live from Washington. This is Africa News Tonight on the VOA. Sports with Sunny is next. And, of course, it's time now for the Sunny Side of Sports with Sunny Young. Happy Tuesday, Sunny.
Happy Tuesday to you, Kim.
Well, Sunny, I understand you are tipping off with a big basketball start.
Kim, if you tuned in to Monday's Sunny Side of Sports, you heard VOA's Andrew Palcheski talk about Kobe Bryant playing in his 18th and final National Basketball Association All-Star Game in Toronto, Canada. Kobe says interacting with his two daughters during the game made it extra special.
You know, they're sitting right behind the bench, so I was talking to them virtually the whole game, and they've enjoyed this as much as I have. And, you know, when coming to these arenas and, you know, because they've seen me throughout the years get up at 4 in the morning and work out and train and then come home and then work out again. And so it's awesome as a father for them to be able to see, you know, all the hard work and how it pays off.
Kobe Bryant says playing in his final All-Star game was a real thrill.
It was fun. I mean, I had a blast. You know, it was you know, playing with those guys and, you know, laughing and joking with them on the bench. And I got a chance to stop Powell in a post, redeem myself from what he did to me when Chicago came to town. So, but all those things were just fun. I had a great time.
Los Angeles Lakers superstar Kobe Bryant speaking after the recent NBA All-Star Game in Toronto, Canada. Kobe's final season has been a tough one in terms of wins and losses. The Lakers have a record of 11 wins and 44 losses. That's the second worst in the NBA behind the Philadelphia 76ers, who have a record of 8 wins and 45 losses. Kobe and the Lakers have a few days off before the NBA regular season resumes. The defending NBA champion Golden State Warriors are having a great season. They have the league's best record, 48 victories and 4 defeats. In pro boxing, Filipino star Manny Pacquiao will fight American Timothy Bradley for a third time on April 9th in Las Vegas, Nevada. In their first fight in 2012, Bradley won a controversial split decision. Pacquiao then won the rematch by unanimous decision in 2014. I asked our reigning prince of pugilistics, Namdi Hollywood Moueta, how Pacquiao Bradley 3 is shaping up.
Well, the fans don't really care for this third fight because these guys have fought twice, you know, and we know who won the two. It's Manny Pacquiao. Manny Pacquiao may not be able to get up for this fight. He's got the elections. He wants to be a senator in the Philippines. He wants to end his career with this last fight. And I don't see him getting up for this fight. He's going to train in the middle of Hollywood. You don't train in the middle of Hollywood for a big fight. People go to the mountains to train, seclude themselves. This guy's going to be in Hollywood doing the Hollywood shuffle. Celebrities will be coming to the gym. His eyes will not be on the ball, Sonny. And that's why I call for a big upset. This may be the first big upset of 2016, and I think that can happen.
Pac-Man has said this will be his final fight, Namdi.
I'm so happy hanging my gloves after this fight because of what I have done. You know, it's... I feel... I'm sure I will feel sad after that, but that's life. Not all the time you keep on fighting, not in the time, all the time is you're in the ring. But it's time, I think.
Do you think that'll be the case?
I don't think so, because it's still a big money fight. If he beats Bradley, Money Mayweather will come out of retirement for number 50 and they will close it, and that's a big multi-million dollar fight. You don't run away from big money.
What about Mayweather-Bradley, Namdi? Is that a possibility?
No, that's not a possibility, because the promoter of Bradley is Bob Arum of Top Rank, so they don't break bread together. They don't like each other between Mayweather and Bob Arum, so that's not going to happen.
Namdi, how about an update on some of the African fighters and what they've been up to, both in and out of the ring?
Well, Sonny, you know how happy I am for my homeboy from Nigeria and Britain, AJ Anthony Joshua, who is 15-0. Well, he's the best out of Britain right now. Martin, who is the IBF champion, that's a title that was once owned by Tyson Fury, he now wants to go to London and tangle with homeboy AJ April 9th at the O2 Arena, which is going to be a good fight.
Still with the heavyweights, Namdi, Tyson Fury, is he still lined up for a rematch against Vladimir Klitschko?
Yeah, but he wants to bring the fight to the UK, and Vladimir wants the fight to be in Germany, which doesn't really make sense for the fight to be in Germany. The new champion is a British guy, and he can call the shot. He wants the fight in Britain. The fight has to be in Britain.
One of the big American hopes in the heavyweight division, Deontay Wilder. Do you see him going up against Anthony Joshua or Tyson Fury, Namdi?
Not right now. He keeps fighting bombs because he'll make money fighting bombs. So why fight a tiger if you don't need to fight a tiger? He's blowing guys out of the ring for nothing, you know, and he makes $3-4 million. Come on, why fight a tiger? You know, it makes no sense, you know. So he keeps knocking out bombs till then he have to go for a mandatory fight. But he's got a Russian, Povetkin, coming up, which he may not even fight him and just give up the belt and fight somebody else.
Namdi, I know you've been critical of the heavyweight division in recent years, but do you kind of sense some more excitement about the big boys, that more people are watching the heavyweights?
Oh, the big boys, they bring the action. There's nothing like seeing the heavyweight being knocked out, cold on the floor, you know. The boxing fans, they go crazy. When the big boys, they land big, you know. So you enjoy watching the heavyweight on the floor, the referee counting him out, and he can get up. It's a wow, that's a good fight. The action is back now, so we're really excited about it. Heavyweight is the good division.
Thanks, Namdi. That's our reigning prince of pugilistics, Namdi Hollywood Mawaita, talking with us again from Los Angeles, California. Just ahead on the sunny side of sports, my VOA colleague James Buddy will have a Black History Month segment on a basketball great and a former world heavyweight boxing champion.
Get up, stand up. Stand up for your right.
It's time now for our Black History Month fact for today, February 16th. In 1970, Joe Frazier became world heavyweight boxing champion after knocking out Jimmy Ellis in the second round at Madison Square Garden in New York City. On this day in 1972, during a basketball game between the Los Angeles Lakers and the Phoenix Suns, Will Chamberlain became the first man in the history of the NBA to score 30,000 points.
We heard James Buddy say how Wilt Chamberlain became the first NBA player to score 30,000 career points. The late, great Chamberlain ended his career with 31,419 points. That puts him at fifth all-time. Kobe Bryant, who we heard from at the beginning of the show, is at number three all-time. Kobe currently has 33,243 points. The now-retired Kareem Abdul-Jabbar is the NBA's all-time leading scorer with 38,387 points. Turning to African club football, the Zimbabwean clubs Chicken Inn and Harare City are off to good starts in the CAF Champions League and CAF Confederation Cup tournaments. Michael Cariati tells us more from Zimbabwe's capital, Harare.
It was a weekend of celebration for Chicken Inn and Harare City fans after their teams recorded victories in their first romance with Pan-African football. For Chicken Inn, it was a sweet 1-0 victory over glamorous South African club Mamelodi Sundowns ahead of the return leg in 2 weeks' time. The all-important goal for the Gamecocks came from Michel Cachairo in the 36th minute. It was also a sweet return for the Brazilians' manager Peter Ndlovu, who started his career at Muzilika's primary school and later at Highlanders in Bulawayo before going all the way to play in the Barclays Premiership with Coventry City way back in 1991.
I'm happy to be back home, and also it's where I made my name, where Highlanders gave me a chance. And it's good to come here back as a manager of another team, but I've got fond memories, and that makes it so special.
Although the Gamecocks have a tough assignment in their away game, their coach Joey Antipas thinks the goal scored is good enough for his team to advance to the next round. Antipas says their target was to come out with a goalless draw against such illustrious opponents, and adds that he is proud of his boys for their achievement.
To tell you the truth, we went out to try and play for 0-0, but we managed to get 1-0 up against quality opponents like Sundowns. Very chuffed about the win. I'm proud about the boys. They maintained our tactical discipline.
Also celebrating were Harare City, who took a 3-2 advantage after squandering a 2-0 lead to give Madagascar's AS Adema a glimmer of hope ahead of the second leg. The coach of the Harare City Fathers, Taurai Mambiro, said they were very, very careless in their defense to allow the little-known Madagascan side to score 2 goals.
Having led at halftime, I thought the floodgates will open. It wasn't to be. Poor organization at the back. We were careless in the manner in which we defended. They got a penalty, and suddenly it came on.
Harare City had taken a first half 2-0 lead through new boys Ronald Chitu and Rafael Manuvere, but the visitors clawed back to even the scores before Manuvere gave the Zimbabweans the winner in the 85th minute. However, Manguiro says he's happy that they got that winning goal in the dying stages of the match.
I'm happy we had that goal in the dying stages of the match, and it can make a big difference come the second leg.
The return legs in both the CAF Champions League and the CAF Confederation Cup will be played before the end of this month. Reporting in Harare, this is Michael Cariati.
Thanks, Michael. More African football news. Frenchman Hervé Renard was named Morocco's head coach on Tuesday. The 47-year-old Renard led both Zambia and Ivory Coast to Africa Cup of Nations titles, winning with the Zambians in 2012 and Ivory Coast in 2015. He's now charged with leading the Moroccans to the 2018 World Cup in Russia. I'm VOA Sonny Young, and that's the sunny side of sports. Back to Yahias Wuhib and Kim Lewis.
Thank you, Sonny. And listen to the Sunny Side of Sports Monday through Friday at 1631 UTC and 1831 UTC. And on Fridays, Sunny has an expanded half-hour edition of the Sunny Side of Sports at 1730 hours UTC, right here on the Voice of America.
Coming up, distributing water to more than 400,000 residents in South Sudan. And next, a call by the United Nations to end female genital mutilation. But first, some music. Here is Nino Galisa from Guinea-Bissau with Africa Today.
Today, Africa. We don't want war.
We don't.
Africa today.
Africa.
We don't want sadness.
We don't.
Africa today.
Africa.
We don't want hunger.
We don't.
Africa today.
Africa.
We don't want more arms.
We don't.
From Guinea-Bissau with Africa Today.
Well, South Sudan's Urban Water Corporation is building a 180,000 cubic liter water distribution plant to improve the supply of water to Juba, the nation's capital. The agency says it plans to distribute water to more than 400,000 residents. Officials believe the new Japanese-funded plant will help prevent the spread of waterborne diseases, which have been rampant in Juba in recent months. Mugumi Davis Wakaringe reports.
The $50 million-plus project is funded by the Japanese International Cooperation Agency, or JICA. Speaking at the project's launch, site engineer Lawrence Lopula Muludiang said they are constructing a water reservoir at the Parliament building, which will distribute water to additional parts of Juba.
There's a line going to Munuki, Gudere. There's another one going to Mauna Custom Market. There's another one going through Kator, Lologo. The means of distribution is using tanker truck stations so that we can stop tanker trucks from getting river water to your household. 8 of them dotted in the 3 payams making Juba City. And then there are 120 public water kiosks.
Lopla says it's not clear exactly how much the project will cost, but the Japanese International Cooperation Agency is paying for it.
The Japanese government started by funding the Juba Water Supply Master Plan. I think it was over $2 million. And then we went to the Japanese Grant Aid Project, which is this current project under construction, which is $48 million. The capacity development component is about $5 and $6 million.
Lopula says the South Sudan Water Corporation will also provide piped water to thousands of additional subscribing households and offices. He says that means most Juba residents will have access to clean, affordable water.
This will help in preventing the cholera outbreaks that break out every year. The local people will now have public water points near their house and stop the women from having long distance to queue and buy water, and children to go and fetch water from faraway places, and they can go to school.
Lopala says right now, only about 30% of the population in Juba receives clean water. He says most of the water pipes in Juba, which were constructed in the early 1950s, are worn out and have many leaks. Hirotaka Sato, JICA's chief advisor for the project, says his agency will train some local personnel on how to run the water project.
We train about leakage survey technology. Then we train the staff how to use such equipment. We train how to fix the service connection, how to repair the service connection.
Madol Chut Chep, deputy managing director for the Urban Water Corporation, believes training of local personnel will ensure the sustainability of the water supply project.
There will be training of how to monitor the water actually through the pipe, so that they can know whether there is a leakage, there is damage. There is something that there is a leakage that you can see when the water bursts out. You can see, but there is small thing inside. You cannot see. And when there is a leakage, that is mean that the thing can get into the water and they can just go along.
Juba resident Lesuk Emmanuel Alson welcomes the initiative.
Sometimes you find that the tanks of water, they cannot fix some other areas in time, and you find that other people cannot afford the money to buy. Like the drum of water is now £25 in area in Nyokuron here. But when going to Gurei site, it is around £30, which is very hot.
Alson says sometimes he fails to eat because he does not have water to cook food. The project is expected to be completed in September of next year. For VOA News, I am Mugume Devs Ruakarinj in Juba.
The United Nations is calling for an end to female genital mutilation. Victims and medical experts say the harmful practice causes short and long-term physical and psychological damage. Malian singer Ina Moja is a survivor of female genital mutilation. Moja recently performed for an event at the United Nations in New York and talked with Lenord Moudou from the UN headquarters in New York about what she is doing to put an end to the practice.
Malian singer Ina Moja is a survivor of female genital mutilation, or CATing, FGMC. Moja, who recently performed at an event at the United Nations in New York, has called for a complete end to the practice.
As an African woman, I went through female genital mutilation. I know what it is, and I know how harmful it is. And I want to protect those younger girls and those generation coming, because FGM has to end.
The UN's Children's Agency, UNICEF, says more than 200 million girls and women globally have suffered genital mutilation, far higher than previously estimated. The ancient ritual, practiced in some countries in Africa, Asia, and the Middle East, usually involves the partial or total removal of a girl's external genitalia. Moja, who now lives in France, has undergone reconstructive surgery. Moja, who now lives in France, has undergone reconstructive surgery to reverse FGM procedure. But she says the scars remain.
Et le fait de m'être fait réparer.
Getting repaired via reconstructive surgery by Professor Pierre Foldes also helped me to heal. It helped me to heal physically and psychologically, and somehow it repaired me. But when you say repair, there's always a scar. It's like when you break a glass and glue it back together. There are always break lines, and my excisions are my break lines.
UN Secretary General Ban Ki-moon says new and unharmful rites of passage should replace female genital mutilation.
Let us shift the focus away from mutilation to education. Let us make a world where FGM stands for focus on girls' minds.
Ending female genital mutilation is part of a set of development goals adopted by UN member states last year. Goal 5 counts among its targets, eliminating FGM by 2030. Somalia has the highest rate of FGM, where figures show 98% of women and girls between age 15 and 49 have been cut. Guinea, Djibouti, and Sierra Leone also have very high rates.
That was reporter Leonard Mudu reporting. This is Africa News Tonight on the Voice of America on the following frequencies, 15580 and 6080 kilohertz. Tune in to Africa News Tonight at 16 and 18 hours UTC, Monday through Friday. And with that, we wrap up this edition of Africa News Tonight. Up next, our VOA editorial. I'm Ihez Wuhib in Washington.
And I'm Kim Lewis. And for all the latest developments on the continent 24/7, visit our website at voaafrica.com. And on behalf of our Africa News Tonight producer, Bill Workinger, and our engineer, John Dryden, thanks for choosing the Voice of America.
An international public service announcement by the United States government.
The United States has expanded its offer of rewards for information on key leaders of terrorist organizations to include a leader of one of the groups conducting attacks on government facilities and other targets in northern Nigeria, roiling the nation in sectarian violence. Abubakar Shekau is the leader of the group commonly known as Boko Haram, a Nigeria-based extremist organization seeking to overthrow the current government there and replace it with a regime based on a strict interpretation of Islamic law. Links with terrorist groups such as Al-Qaeda and Al-Shabaab have strengthened Boko Haram's capacity to conduct its attacks. Previously, the group's number two, Shekau claimed overall command in July 2010, expressing solidarity with Al-Qaeda and threatening the United States. A vehicle bomb attack on the United Nations headquarters in Abuja in August 2011 marked the group's first lethal operation against Western interests, killing at least 23 people and injuring 80 others. In April 2012, the group bombed a Nigerian newspaper office in Abuja and later threatened other local and international news outlets, including the Voice of America. Under his leadership, the group has kidnapped hundreds of children to serve as hostages, bearers, and even fighters, most recently in the northeastern town of Damasak. Shekau is tall, slim, and has a dark complexion. He was born in Yobe, Nigeria, sometime between 1965 and 1975, and is of the Kanuri ethnicity. He speaks Arabic, Hausa, Fulani, and Kanuri. He is known to have used the aliases Abubakar Sikwa and Imam Abubakar Shiku. The Rewards for Justice program is offering a reward of up to $7 million for information leading to Shekau's location. The U.S. promises that all credible reports will be investigated and the identity of all informants will be kept confidential. If appropriate, the U.S. is prepared to protect informants by relocating them and their families. If you have information on this man, contact the nearest U.S. embassy or consulate or submit a tip to www.rewardsforjustice.net. or email information to info@rewardsforjustice.net. You may also call the Rewards for Justice tip line at 1-800-877-3927.
That was an international public service announcement by the United States government.
Tuesday on Health Chat, host Lenore Modou discusses female circumcision, also known as female genital cutting. Our guest is Angela M. Peabody, president and founder of Global Woman Peace Foundation. For your questions, email us at healthchat@voanews.com. You can also reach us by phone to leave a message or to participate in the program. We will call you back. Dial the international code for the United States, then dial 202-205-9942. The country code is 1. Dial 45 after you hear the station ID. For listeners to call during the show, our telephone number is 202-619-3111. Health Chat this Tuesday at 1730 UTC, right here on VOA Africa.